We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate, and Five Star App Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, your host, along with my co-host this week, Muse co-founder Ariel Garten. Before we get started, a reminder to check out our free meditations on Muse or Meditation Studio. And if you and your family want to learn to meditate while you're at home or just deepen your practice, use the discount code MUSESTRESSLESS for your Muse headband at choosemuse.com. We're thinking of all of you and wishing you the very best. Now on to today's episode with Ariel.
Hello, everyone. Ariel here, and my amazing guest today is Dr. Stan Tatkin. So, question for y'all. Are you cooped up with someone and you might be feeling a little bit more anxious than usual, and possibly there are moments of the relationship that are not going so smoothly? Do you possibly wish you had more tools to help support yourself and your partner through this process, whether that partner is your husband or wife or your child? Well, Dr. Kat Tatkin is on the forefront of couples research and therapy, and he's the founder of PACT, the psychobiological approach to couples therapy. He'll share with us how to observe and understand where our partners are coming from and how to regulate your and their behavior in some interesting ways. He also, which I didn't realize before we started communicating with one another, is a Muse user, and he'll be employing Muse in some of his psychobiology research. And I have to say, I've begun to use some of the insights that he shared with me with my spouse, and it has already helped. So I'm very much looking forward to everybody hearing what Stan has to share, and to bit by bit improving the relationships inside of our very packed homes. Welcome, Stan.
Hi, Ariel. How are you?
I am wonderful, and even more wonderful for hearing your voice. Hello.
Thank you. And I'm sorry I had such a problem with my camera. Your audience should know that I had technical problems with spilling tea on my computer this morning. So that's why my camera isn't working. Otherwise, I'd love to be able to see you as we're talking.
That's okay. They can hear your voice.
Good.
They can be guided by your deep timbre and deep insight.
Wonderful.
So, Stan, can you share just at the get-go one of the things that you've found very powerful in working with couples who are cooped up due to COVID?
It's interesting that we've kind of gone back to a time that we used to enjoy not that long ago. I might be older than some in your audience, but before there were so many distractions and so much information just bombarding us. The speed of information has increased so much just in our lifetime that now we're having to be with each other. And there are good things, obviously, and some things that are very difficult and challenging. As we kind of turn the clock back and find ourselves spending more time interacting with each other, and maybe for some people, more time in reverie and meditating or noticing the small things, not being so driven perhaps, and even reaching out to people that we may have forgotten about and wondered how they're doing. So yeah, it is depending on your relationship and whether you have young children like you do, or whether you have teenagers like other people do, your mileage, of course, is going to vary. But this is a time, I think, for people to do what should always be done, and that is to think about what's really important. And what we know is really important by studying people on their deathbeds, the thing that people lament the most or are happy about the most is the quality of their relationships and whether they're in good order or not. Now is a good time to make sure our relationships are in good order, or to do as best we can to focus on what's important. And of course, I'm a relationships person.
So how do you go about doing that? I mean, it's difficult to take a marriage where you're tense and frustrated in a situation where you're cooped up together in a house and therefore even more tense and frustrated, and all of a sudden say, I'm going to make this better. Like, what are the practical steps that you take?
Well, I think spending actual quality time, and that is time where there is no distraction. And that may be difficult for some people, but nighttime and mornings are two of the most important periods for children and for adults. And yet we, as adults, we really don't pay very much attention to that. These are periods of separation and reunion. And there's the art of pillow talk, where we would spend time just shooting the breeze and not be distracted, have nothing to do, lie there in boredom and see what arises. So there has to be some periods of repose, relaxation, peace, in order to replenish, in order to gather oneself. And to do that with another person is far more energizing and resourcing than doing it alone. This is hard for some people who are accustomed to do everything alone, and they need their alone time, which is why I'm saying these periods ought to be without demand, low distraction, kind of like what we might remember as being on a campout and a sleepover, where you'd be relaxed and you would just start to riff. You would just start to be with each other and be in real time, rather than in our heads, rather than planning, rather than remembering and worrying about things or talking about business. So that would be one thing I would recommend, just a time of something we call quiet love, which is being in an alert and relaxed state. And one way to just start that is by lying there or just being there and not saying anything, at least for a time, and just hanging out together. I know it seems strange, but like a science experiment, try it and see what happens. Putting each other to bed at night, waking up in the morning is very resourcing for most people. At least you can try it and see if it works for you. There are other things that people can do, but I think that in the combination of having an existential threat, which, by the way, has always been there, even though we can name it right now as COVID-19, and dealing with unseen fear, which we did after 9/11, we don't know what is around the corner, who our neighbor is. Now we don't know who has it, who doesn't have COVID. So there's that pressure, that stress of finances, stress of work, all of this, that it just makes sense if you are partnered to take some quiet time, whether it's with two muses and being together or going face to face, eye to eye without talking, and practicing outsight meditation where you are studying your partner's face while relaxing your body. There's so many things, but in order to deal with conflict, there has to be some modicum of resourcing. I think this is an easier thing to prescribe than to jump right into doing very loving things with each other, which may be difficult if people are having a hard time getting along.
So the initial prescription is just hang out. Just spend just sweet time doing nothing, close to each other, and hanging out.
Yes, whether it's face-to-face, eye-to-eye, or just lying on your backs, but just being together in quiet, relaxed, and alert, and see what happens. We definitely recover and restore better with a person than we do when we're alone.
Yeah, I was just going to turn to there. I recall in your work you talking about how we co-regulate more effectively than we regulate ourselves. And that's such an interesting notion to me, particularly in these times when we can be so anxious and dysregulated, that it's actually easier to co-regulate two people at a time than for one person to regulate themselves. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Here's the rub, though. There's nothing more difficult on the planet than another person. And so it both is something we need. We need another person. We need to interact with another human brain in order to not go insane.
Which we're all really discovering at this point. Yes, the value of other people around us to keep our sanity.
Exactly. I mean, dogs and cats are wonderful, but they can't replace a human brain, and nor can a Wilson ball. So we need another person. However, the problem, of course, is interpersonal stress. So as infants, we have three ways that we manage ourselves, and they're all normative and they're all there at birth. One is called autoregulation, and that is self-stimulation and self-soothing without the need of another person. It's not antisocial, it's just not pro-social. It's a state of hyper-focus or self-play. We all do it even throughout life. We read a book, we're autoregulating. We watch a movie. If we're not talking during it, we're auto-regulating. So it's normal. But it is not engaged, not in the same way as co-regulation, interactive regulation. That is there also from birth, even though in the first year, the caregiver always lets the infant lead. Even though the infant is leading play and the caregiver is following, you cannot tell who's leading and following once the play begins. And that's called interactive regulation. That's what we're built for. Only two human beings can do it in the primate world. So that's an eye-to-eye, skin-to-skin, face-to-face proposition. And we're naturals at it. And it is how we learn eventually to self-regulate. And that isn't an ability until around 10, 11, 12 months, with the frontal area becoming metabolic. And so we have external regulation in childhood where it's in one direction only. So the caregiver is feeding, is talking, making sounds, regulating the infant's nervous system, so to speak, and thermoregulation and so on, sleep-wake cycles. But that's normal too throughout life, except it is not effective in adult relationships. So two things that are not good to rely on too much in an adult relationship. One is autoregulation, that's playing by yourself. And the other is too much external regulation, which we used to think of as codependency. Co-regulation is something that isn't thought. It happens in close proximity, and people will naturally error correct as they go unless there's threat. And then we have the problem with interpersonal stress and why some people or a lot of people are having a hard time right now at home with their adult partners.
Because you're looking for your partner to help you regulate. You're stressed out and anxious, and so you want to hug, you want to sit with them, you want to calm yourself over dinner, but then they to you are also a source of stress, and so the threat from them makes that co-regulation much harder.
Unless there's error correction. So you and I are face-to-face and two separate brains, never on the same page, ever at the same time. There's only an approximation of our minds, but we're never actually on the same page. We've never lived outside of our heads and we never will. So right there's a problem. Our perceptions are shifting and changing according to our state of mind. Our memories are changing our state of mind, which are changing our perceptions. And the chance for you and I of misstepping and looking a certain way, sounding a certain way, using a certain word or phrase at just the right or wrong time is about 100%.
Yep.
That's built into the human primate. The exquisite capacity to scan and to pick up threat cues in the environment. That's how we're built. We're built to survive. And That's a feature in one area and a bug in another.
And a massive bug when you're when you're in an area feeling threatened inside or outside your house. And even though the threat may diminish, amygdala continues to repeat that fear to you over and over and over again, whether you like it or not, whether it's helpful or not.
Absolutely.
Whether it keeps you safe or not.
Yes. And this is normal. And yet I think people, because when we feel hurt or in distress, we tend to be much more self-protective. And when we're self-protective with a partner that we're interdependent with, that person may mistake our self-protection as being threatening. And so it's very easy for two people to square off and to forget that they're in each other's care, not simply their own. So that's why I say self-regulation is needed in order to be in a relationship, but it's the interactive regulation, which has to be eye to eye, that actually bolsters our ability to manage ourselves. We have to understand we're interactional animals. Everything we learn is from the outside in, and that continues in adulthood. We learn to love by loving. We learn to be loved by loving, and vice versa. This is an interaction that's constantly in play. So the big problem, Ariel, is when we're not feeling good. When we're feeling good, everything's fine. When we're feeling good, we make all these errors in our communication and appraisal, but we give each other wiggle room. When we're not feeling good, that wiggle room narrows greatly, and that's when we start to become more sensitive in the area of threat cues. And this is memory-based. The reason that romantic relationships are the hardest on the planet is because the only relationship like it is the earliest ones we had when we depended on caregivers. And it's a memory issue. So love relationships have a long memory going back to early childhood. So we're not just dealing with the memory that you and I create. We're dealing with the memory that even led to us picking each other in the first place, because we pair bond by recognition. So all of this to say that I think we're all very hard on ourselves because we don't understand the nature of being human and the error potentials of the brain. And so we get into trouble and we forget that everybody's doing the best they can. They're just most of the time acting automatically, reflexively, according to memory.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now back to our show.
I want to go back to a phrase that you said to underscore it because it's so beautiful and was sort of a wake-up call, that we are in each other's care.
Yes.
And I think, you know, as couples in stress, it is so easy to forget that. And probably you know, if you're in a household that's stressed right now, it's hard to forget that we are in one another's care. And that very phrase becomes very kind of opening and gives the permission to let go of the stress or the grudge or the frustration and seek the other's care and offer care to the other.
Absolutely. Being in each other's care means, and I'm just going to go a step further, that we're both oriented toward putting the relationship as the most important thing. The relationship is a third thing that we create, co-create with its own ethos, ethics, rules, principles that we create and are constantly creating that allows us to live and breathe, allows us to survive and thrive. So it's by agreement. So in each other's care means that we're both stakeholders. in ensuring each other's absolute safety and security at every moment. Now, that's hard to do because we're messy creatures and we make a lot of errors. And that's where repair comes in. That's where, I'm sorry, you're right, I shouldn't have done that. That's where your perception matters more than what I think is fact or true. The relationship coming first means that's first before being right. And therefore, if you, Ariel, feel that I misunderstood you or that I looked a certain way or had a certain tone of voice, putting the relationship first and that you're in my care means that I don't argue with that. That my first thing is to repair that, to fix that. That if you feel hurt, that's the most important thing. My job is to take care of that. And you do the same with me. That's a higher level of agreement where we are ensuring each other's well-being by having humility and by believing in something greater than ourselves. And that's the relationship that we're creating.
It's really lovely.
Hard thing to do.
A very hard thing to do. What are some practical steps, short of listening to this podcast with your partner, which you may wish to do because you both have to be on the same page to participate in this way? What are some practical steps to how you break through the stress or the fear or the feeling pitted against one another and reconnect in these ways?
There are so many things to say in answer to that. There's a hierarchy, and so let me just start with that. One thing that people can do, since we're going to do the same stupid things every day anyway, no matter how much we complain, because we're automatic. About 90% of our day is automatic. And you're a brain person, so you know the brain.
I know how many times I put the cup in the wrong part of the dishwasher over and over and over again. Yes, it's spectacular how many times you can make the same mistake.
And yet we never really thank ourselves or the brain or nature or each other for all the things that we actually get and do every day. We only think about the things that are missing or the things that go wrong. But spending this time, like working on a puzzle together, spending this time plotting out the future, what is the purpose of our union? What's the meaning of us? What do we do for each other that's so expensive that nobody would ever want to do unless they got paid a lot of money? What agreements can we make to ensure each other's well-being as two separate, annoying, burdensome, disappointing human beings? What can we envision as a shared vision together that would create a culture, a union, a state, a corp, a fiefdom that is of our making consciously and not the makings of our childhood or our parents or their parents? Two different people, nothing wrong with us, except that we don't have a shared vision, we don't have a shared purpose, and we don't have guardrails that keep us from doing stupid things that all human beings will do. That would be a nice project to just muse about. Why not? Why not think about what kind of couple should we be in 5 years from now? What would be the measure of us as a couple, not as individuals, not what I want, you want, but what we want? How are we behaving? Are we behaving in a way that our children admire, that our children would want to emulate when they have their relationships? Are we, in terms of theater, are we showing instead of just telling how we interact in the world and how we do relationship? That would be a huge start, because without a shared purpose and a shared meaning, tools go out the window when we're in distress.
But when you're in distress, that's a very difficult place to start from.
That's why you do it in the calm place that I'm describing.
So something, which I appreciate, but some people listening to this may really be in distress. So that's a high level goal. What are some practical in the moment tools that you can use to defray what it already exists in a stressful situation?
Go face to face, first of all. We're legally blind on the sides of our eyes. You mentioned the amygdala. The amygdala fires more rapidly when we see a face from the side. So go face to face and eye to eye, relatively close distance, and keep your eyes on each other at all times. Take turns talking. Don't spend too long keeping your partner waiting to interact. go back and forth, stay orderly and stay on topic, and see if you can take care of one issue, one thing, without going off topic, without adding more wood to the pile, to the fire. See if you can get something done as a team, as collaborators, to take a problem, a misunderstanding, something you're trying to work on off the table just for now while getting something done. So let's say, what's a typical thing that people might be getting into right now? I mean, there's so many, but there's only so many areas, money, time, mess, sex, kids, right, that people get into. And I also want to assure people that it's never any of those five things. That's what we fight about, perhaps. But the problems between two individuals always can be found in their interactions, which are, by the way, lightning fast. So do this and do it slowly. Otherwise, you won't be able to correct each other. Keep in mind that if you only talk for yourself, if you only state what's important to you without keeping your partner in mind, you'll square off. Everybody will do it. So if I'm only talking about my concern with you, what I want with you, and I make no mention of what I know your concerns are, or what you've been wanting, or what I've been doing to cause you grief, you're naturally going to become adversarial, and now we're going to go to war. So that would be the first recommendation, is face-to-face, eye-to-eye. Your focus is on your partner. Their focus is on you. And you're trying to get something done. I would even recommend setting the timer for 10 minutes and see if you can even do it. Pick something small. Pick something like mess, or something that doesn't have a lot of history to it, perhaps. And see if you can work something out in 10 minutes as a team, as two bosses, two generals, two collaborators, and work on the problem and not on each other.
I love that reframing, the idea of the object of the fight not being right. A fight that you're having with each other, but right. A problem that you're solving together.
That's the way it always should be. If I have a problem, you
Whoa.
Have a problem. If I have a problem, then because we're connected, we're tied together, our wagons are hitched. If I have a problem, that means you have a problem. We take that problem, we put it on the floor, so to speak, as a third thing, and we work on it as a puzzle without devolving into, it's your fault, this is a problem I'm having with you. That will go nowhere. Our proclivity to go to war is legend. We're warlike creatures. The game here is see if you can work as a team. The image I have, Ariel, have you ever played that picnic game where you put your legs with your partner, your inner legs, in a potato sack and you have to run together?
Of course.
So you know that if the two of you aren't working together, you'll just fall.
Yes.
If both people go in the opposite direction, they don't go anywhere. I want people to understand that they are and they have been in a potato sack race. They either move together or they get nothing done and they feel bad and they feel incompetent and they get angry with each other because they're not working together. So yes, you work the problem, not each other.
That's great. That's really effective.
Good. People are hard.
We are. We are fascinating and difficult creatures.
We are really difficult, yes. Me included. I'm including myself.
Yeah, you know, yet oddly lovable.
I think we all are. We're just built so much more for war than love, because nature does not have a plan for a relationship, only for a continuation of the species. That's a problem, because we, you know, relationship is important to us in our life. And then we have to really work at it. It just does not come natural. I mean, it does in the beginning when we're in courtship and we're on drugs, because we're superheroes in the beginning, able to do everything because nature's love potion.
Oxytocin, it's a darn good thing, yep.
Oxytocin, vasopressin, not to mention a good dose of testosterone. So these drugs wear off and now we're back to our basic selves. And then there's that automation thing where we automate each other and we think we know each other, but we don't. We stop paying attention. We stop staying present. And this is natural, but a problem. Again, it's natural and it's good because it conserves energy. It's a problem because our error rates with each other go way, way, way sky high because we're not paying attention.
So you talk about paying attention to one another. Can you tell us briefly about PACT, about the psychobiological approach to couples therapy? You talk a lot about the brain and the biology and how that leads to our interactions and behaviors, which is not something you often hear couples therapists talk about. Can you bring us into that world a little?
Sure. Psychobiology is the study of the brain and the body. And psychobiologists generally are developmentalists studying infants and infant brain development and development through the lifespan. We're particularly interested in the social emotional capacities of individuals and the differences in capacities. Some of them are minor, some of them are major. But we look at critical periods in infancy and then through the lifespan and how good people are with others, particularly in the creation of excitement and in the creation of quiet and in the ability to co-manage distress states. And that's one of the biggest ones. How good are you and I at managing distress? And can we deal with it rather quickly without amplifying it? That takes a certain amount of social emotional acuity developmentally, but also skill in learning. So you can see how that is relevant to adult romantic relationships and the differences in these different pairs, but also the challenges just being in that kind of relationship, given the nature of being human and the fallibilities that are just inherent in the brain and in communication. Communication, by the way, even on a good day, is just terrible. It's really true. We're mostly misunderstanding each other most of the time. If people just understood that, they'd get along better.
So the idea is that you have an ability as an infant or as a young person to regulate in distress relative to another, probably your mother, primary caregiver, and that ability to co-regulate during distress then yes. Suggests how you will be co-regulating in distress as an adult in your primary relationship?
It's sort of the building blocks because development moves on throughout the lifespan, but there are critical periods that are sort of building blocks as the brain is being developed. And a lot of that is nature, but so much of it is the environment and our interactions that are millions of trillions and zillions of interactions with our caregivers throughout childhood that begin to form how we manage certain states, certain emotional states in ourselves and in other people. So if we had parents that never, ever got angry, ever showed it, ever, we would, of course, have a hard time managing states that are angry in another person or in ourselves. Or if we had parents that were angry and rageful and scary, then we'll have a hard time also with anger in ourselves and within another. So we're talking about this ability to very quickly, because our interactions are at lightning speeds, faster than thought. So that's why this ability to do this really well is something that has to be worked on when we're not upset and practice when we're not upset, because when we go live, that's when we are the most automatic and that's when we are the most self-protective and we're more likely to do something we'll regret. So we don't try to avoid conflict because that's a good way to be in conflict. Practicing it when we're not upset, planning, predicting each other, what could possibly go wrong, right? And working with each other so that when we do become fully automatic, only one of us needs to sort of wake up and do something different to change the trajectory by shifting the other person's state. Is that a little too complicated?
No, but I would love some examples. And I would love examples, particularly of how you self-regulate in the off times so that you can more effectively co-regulate.
Here's an example. You and I get into a place, we're automatic, and we go to war, figuratively, and it crescendos and ends up a terrible mess, and we feel awful afterwards. But let's say during this loop that we get into, one of us decides to do something completely unexpected that's friendly. Suddenly, I go on the floor, go belly up like a dog. Or suddenly, I get on my knees, I take your hands, I bow to you, and I say, I love you so much. Or there's so many things here. That disconnects the threat circuit immediately. And it changes the trajectory of this whole process to where now we're able to think again. And we're able to interact much more in a state of safety. See, the problem is when we get upset, at least one of us has to do something to restore safety. Mm-hmm. And that's done usually through a gesture or a word or a facial expression or lowering oneself, like in the animal world, anything to show the other person I'm friendly. This is how we learn how to remember during those times that we're in something here, we're altered. One of us needs to remember to do something that we know will work or we'll guess will work in some act of silliness, but friendliness that's unexpected, and that right away shifts things. At the bottom of all this, we're dealing with problems having to do with state. That's the problem with two human beings, is not being able to co-manage a state that's distressful. And there are tricks to doing it. But that's what we're dealing with.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Absolutely. What's the role of a meditation practice in allowing couples to self and co-regulate?
Meditation is one of the best ways, especially if it's insight-oriented, insight meditation, of being able to bolster self-regulatory functions in the brain. And so it allows us to deal with discomfort and have to deal with it internally by witnessing it, and that's a very important part here, building a witness part of our mind that can witness our pain and not act on it, but relax into it. And the attention plus the witnessing plus the relaxing and letting go and acceptance is what sort of builds our immune system when it comes to distress. Distressing thoughts, distressing sensations, distressing feelings. So it's very, very good. We know from multiple studies now that this not only builds cortical thickness in key areas of the brain, but it is absolutely good for one's mental and physical health and immune system and longevity and so on, not to mention happiness. So excellent. Here, though, is the rub. No matter how good we get at meditating and working with ourselves, nothing prepares us for another person. And that's where we get into problems. So is there a way that we can sometimes meditate with each other? Is there a way that sometimes we can be with each other and play together in meditation? Sometimes just doing meditation together in the same room, which is parallel play. That's nice. Or meditating while looking in each other's eyes and using as object of meditation the other person's eyes and face, noting change. In other words, making it much more interpersonal if you're in a couple. At least doing some of those things. And then you can even add more to it than that. You can really get very creative and start to deal with dangerous faces or threatening faces or threatening words and meditate with them.
That's interesting. So you would agree on a threatening word that you would, that might be a trigger word for both of you, and use that as the object of your meditation or a mantra that you are saying over and over again while trying to remain calm or observing the experience of your body while it happens?
Let's say you and I have a pad of paper. We both write down a word, just maybe one or two or three words that really stir us up, or a phrase. Hand it to the other person, one person at a time. You first settle, don't talk, stay with each other, focus on each other's eyes and face. Get settled first. And then partner A reads the partner B's threatening phrase or word. Partner B then just uses that and works with the sensations and relaxes into it, watches it fade, right? This kind of a practice of being able to work with the sensations and the thoughts, and the feelings that come up when that word is used or a tone is used. It's play. It's all play. But it's another way of being, of using mindfulness and mindfulness practice interpersonally. There are a lot of things like this that people can do. This is just one example.
That's really beautiful. And I was quite surprised when we first got connected to each other that you actually use Muse as part of your meditation practice and with your patients sometimes.
I love, 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 love Muse. We have three Muses now, I think, and my wife has one, and I use it daily. I use Muse S now because I love the softness of it, and I use the sleep program, particularly the soundscapes, and I just adore it. It's my go-to.
I have to say, hearing this, I have like my heart's doing little flutters, and I have a funny sensation in my throat, like, oh my God, Stan Tatkin uses Muse and loves it. Oh my God. As someone with a psychotherapy background, I'm here talking to a couples therapy god. it's quite something for me to hear. So thank you.
I love it. And I recommend it to people. And you and I have been talking about the possibility of using it with couples. So as a feedback tool and making it so that they can actually work with their arousal as they're interacting. And we can do all sorts of things to put them under stress. Doing that with couples is very easy. Stressing is very easy. And then having them work with that in real time with a feedback, with a neurofeedback and biofeedback system such as Muse.
Can you talk a little bit about the research that you do, observing couples' faces and their physiological interactions?
Yes, we use something called digital frame analysis. We videotape all couples. And of course, now with the stay at home, we can't do it. But in my office, we use digital video, which, by the way, is used also to play back to the couple immediately so they can see what their faces are doing with their movements, body movements, and what their gestures are like and their voices sound like and so on. Because we don't get a chance to see ourselves this way, and seeing is believing. But then when we study and research couples, we're able to go forward and backward in slow motion, frame by frame, and really start to notice things about how fast things move and how fights start way earlier than people even realize, and how this interactive process between human beings is so gorgeous and so exquisite and so complex and so fast that we use certain techniques to try to be, aspire to be as fast as a video camera in picking up the slightest changes in the face and the body in order to keep track of each partner's reactions to each other at every moment.
And this is a process very good attending to, to my tone. And so this is a process that we as couples can train to a degree through training our awareness. You mentioned earlier awareness being such a key to this interaction that we have with one another.
Absolutely. It's a matter of interest. When I decided I was interested in faces, I studied faces, and I tend to get obsessive about anything that I start studying. And that's a feature and a bug. And so I became fascinated with faces, and I became fascinated with paying attention to the slightest changes in a person's movements. And I can say all the things that we use as markers in the face. But then I became interested in how much got parlayed into empathy, that I found that the more attention I paid to details, the more I fell in love with people, the more my sense of empathy increased. And this is being studied at the moment, but the more we pay attention to our partner's face, the more attention we pay to details, the more we tend to feel fondly about them. And the more empathy, if we were to do an empathy test, the empathy scores actually go up when we pay attention to detail moment by moment in the other person. And they go down when we stop doing it, the score. So there is a connection between being fully present, which you can't do all the time, but you can do throughout the day at different times with your partner. The more attention that we pay to our partner and not ourselves and to everything that's changing, because the face is like a kaleidoscope, the more we tend to fall in love with them, particularly in the eyes. We fall in love through the eyes, with our babies, with our puppies and kittens, with each other. And so that's how we also break through the problem of the automatic brain. The automatic brain is low energy consumption, but we're not present and we're only carrying around a picture of our partner. But when we really look, and people can do this today, tonight, when we really just stop and look and maybe even touch with both hands our partner's face like children do with their parents, suddenly we see them anew, as if we've never hadn't seen them in a long time. That's because we're breaking through the brain's tendency to automate everything and relegate it to procedural memory. Now they're stranger and they're familiar and they're stranger again. That's novel.
Yeah.
So I found that just as a side effect of studying faces, that my feeling of love for people just went up. It's a very strange thing.
And, you know, as I recall the memories of being most deeply in love with my partner, with my husband,
yes,
early on in the relationship, what I immediately go to is those moments staring at his face.
Yes.
And, you know, as you talk about it, I can so deeply feel the sensation of full absorption in the other as I look at the details of his face in those memories.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, such a deep memory experience.
Yeah, I know you have children, but anybody out there that has young children or had young children, you know that children do what the developmentalist Margaret Mahler called customs inspection. Babies at a certain age and children up and through about 7, 8 years old will examine the parent's face, touch it, and it looks like they're falling in love and we fall in love back. They're examining the face, they're touching the face, which is our social organ. And this says something about the nature of us as human primates, that we're face-oriented and touch-oriented, and this gazing into each other's eyes and touching the face, exploring each other's faces, people can try that as an experiment. I dare anybody to walk away from that feeling anything other than, oh, if you do it without joking around, without being rough. As a science experiment, people should try.
I did it earlier today.
Okay.
My 3-year-old's face. And as I did this, you know, intensive feeling of love as I stared at his features, and his features just became so beautiful as I stared at them. So beautiful.
Yes.
Just overwhelmed by it. And I hadn't put together the fact that I was doing this act of close looking and the sensations of love that I had, but I entirely had the experience that you're describing.
Yeah.
And it points to just how powerful the small technique is to break through ice between couples.
Yes.
When you feel like you're angry at the other person or you're feeling not heard or not seen, doing the simple act of looking at their face and falling into it can melt that within you. And then, of course, open the appreciation within them when you're in that close proximity.
It does. And it's hard to do when angry with each other. What I'd suggest to people is to keep in mind that there are existential concerns, right? We are alone. We don't know where we come from. There is no meaning to life and we're going to die. Well, we should add another one. It's an existential issue. If we don't know if our primary attachment relationships will exist tomorrow. So when you do fight, you can say to each other, I hate you, I'm mad at you, I want to punch your face, but we're okay. We're okay is in either as a phrase or a gesture is what everyone has to know in order to be able to breathe, in order to be able to function in a day or to sleep at night. So if Tracy, that's my wife, if Tracy and I are mad at each other at night, we don't worry that we're going to bed mad, but we will touch toes. That's a gesture that says, we're mad, but we're okay. All we need to know is that we're okay. And if people just remember that, even when they're mad, that they signal, I may hate your guts right now, and you haven't heard the end of this, but we're okay. We exist. We still exist. We know that that is extremely important for physical and mental health and longevity. If we don't have that information quickly after we're in a struggle, we'll suffer in remarkable ways that are very, very bad for our physical health. So be mad. If you can recover together in quiet without demand, you'll recover faster. And just signal to each other, we're okay. Anything else you say is fine.
That's wonderful.
But that, yeah, that has to be there.
Wonderful. And also very comforting to know that even one of the most foremost couples therapists goes to bed angry with his wife.
Oh,
and they have friends. That is an incredibly relieving piece of information.
I'm such a
Thank you for that vulnerability.
My wife is the master regulator in our couple. You always know the master regulator. If the master regulator gets the cold or a flu or something, the system kind of breaks down a little. If the other person gets sick, nothing happens. So my wife is very good at me. I like to think I'm good at her too. But no, people are messy. And I definitely can be a very difficult person.
Well, thank you for that. As I said, highly relieving. And I'm sure for other people to hear too, knowing that normal is normal in and of itself is a great relief.
If we weren't equal burdens on each other, I mean that. That's what we get paid the big bucks for. If we weren't equal burdens, what would there be to be grateful for? To count your blessings, of all the things that are given to you despite yourself. In any given day, the things that you get from the people that you love, even if you're mad at them, you still get them. It is another feature and bug of the human brain, is to always be aware of what's missing. And while that's good for hunting and gathering, it's terrible for happiness because we can always dwell on what we don't have and what isn't right and fail to count everything, including what is happening and what we are getting and what people do for us despite ourselves. That's another important thing for people to keep in mind during this time, to make some kind of a practice of loving kindness or gratitude with your partner, either by yourself, make a list, or together. That's just about personal happiness. That's, you don't do it for the other person, you do it for yourself.
So if you had a set of parting thoughts on how to manage with your partner during COVID, what would they be?
Be aware, as Stephen Levine, the late Stephen Levine said, be aware that whatever is here now could be gone in the next minute. It may seem morbid, but it's important to keep in mind so it keeps us from doing what we normally do, which is to take things for granted. This may be the only opportunity you'll have, you don't know, to make amends with your partner or to tell them that you love them or you value them or you're grateful. This may be the only moment. And so I think this is the time to think big, that there are bigger things, more important things, and that is the relationships that we have. And this should be a reminder that life is fragile and life is unpredictable and different, but the two of you should be. And so that would be my parting thought.
Well, thank you very, very much. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. And thank you for sharing very practical ways that we can support one another inside our hearts and inside our houses during this most trying time.
And thank you for creating a beautiful instrument that's going to just grow and flourish, the muse, instrument is an incredible gift.
Oh, that's so kind. Thank you. Have a wonderful night.
You too. Give Chris a hug for me.
I certainly will.
He'll go, what?
For those listening, Chris is my husband. Good night.
Good night.
That was the wonderful Dr. Stan Tatkin, T-A-T-K-I-N. You can find out more of Stan's work at the PACT Institute. That's P-A-C-T, PACTInstitute.com. And you can find his books, We Do, Relationship RX, Wired for Dating, Wired for Love, Your Brain on Love, Love and War and Intimate Relationships, and so much more at Amazon and your favorite bookseller. If you're curious about Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, you can find it at choosemuse.com. Go to the website to discover more of our resources available and the free challenges that we have every month to help you find resilience and calm in this fascinating time. I'm wishing all of you resilience in your heads, in your hearts, in your relationship, in the relationships with those that are under the same roof with you, far away, in your heart close, but in reality far, whatever it is. I'm wishing you connection, togetherness, and all the best. We'll be back next week with more Untangle.